If you're looking at your phone right now, you've found us on mobile, which means we can get a move on. You know me, you know what this is, so let's begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and thanks so much for listening. And that would include all of you patriotic Americans tuning in over there at the NSA. It's a moment of truth right now for the USA Patriot Act and determining just where the president stands on the issue of data collection from U.S. citizens by the NSA without their knowledge. Determining where the president stands is challenging. Once upon a time, right after the Edward Snowden leaks, President Obama seemed appalled and was anxious to reform NSA practices.
I called for a thorough review of our surveillance operations before Mr. Snowden made these leaks. My preference, and I think the American people's preference, would have been for a lawful, orderly examination of these laws, a thoughtful, fact-based debate that would then lead us to a better place.
But it's clear that some in Congress believe that those better places depend on keeping surveillance of U.S. citizens in place. Congress is running out of time to save two sections of the Patriot Act, provisions that this week the president told the nation he now considers essential to protecting national security.
I said over a year ago that it was important for us to properly balance our needs for security with civil liberties. And this administration engaged on a bipartisan, bicameral basis, talking to Republicans and Democrats about how we could preserve necessary authorities, but provide the public greater assurance that those authorities were not being abused.
The Senate will convene for a rare Sunday afternoon session to work on a deal before key provisions of the Patriot Act expire at midnight. The most notable provision is Section 215, used by the NSA to justify collecting bulk data. That's the program Edward Snowden made famous, and the program a federal appeals court deemed illegal earlier this month. And it's also the very same kind of intelligence gathering the president campaigned to end altogether in 2007.
I will provide our intelligence and law enforcement agencies with the tools they need to track and take out the terrorists without undermining our Constitution and our freedom. That means no more illegal wiretapping of American citizens. No more national security letters to spy on citizens who are not suspected of a crime. No more tracking citizens who do nothing more than protest a misguided war. No more ignoring the law when it is inconvenient. That is not who we are.
Well, many years later, the who and the we in this instance are a little unclear. And so joining us is David Sanger, national security correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. David, do we know where the president really stands on this Patriot Act issue? And does there remain any consensus close to what there was when the Patriot Act was quickly passed after the 9/11 attacks?
Well, you know, after the 9/11 attacks, there was no question that Congress would pass just about anything, John, that President Bush at that time would have asked for. And, of course, they renewed the Patriot Act some number of years ago, toward the end of the Bush administration, with very little debate and perhaps very little understanding on the part of members of Congress, other than those who belong to the intelligence committees and a few others, about how the act was actually being interpreted. So if you pick apart what the president said in those various clips, what's really fascinating about it is that for years he renewed the applications to do the kind of surveillance, the bulk collection of telephone numbers, call records, and so forth, that's done under what's called Section 215. And that's the section that was that the court found to be illegally interpreted by the NSA. It seems very likely that when this is all done on Sunday, Section 215 will go away and we'll go back to the way things were before the Patriot Act, which is that these records were just held by the phone companies and they would have to respond to a specific court order. But the government couldn't collect them in bulk.
Do the cynics on the Hill and in the national security beltway culture believe that there's an easy workaround here, or does this really fundamentally change the way intelligence would be collected by the U.S. government?
You know, there's a dirty little secret to this, John, which is that the NSA didn't particularly care for Section 215, the bulk collection of this data, even before Snowden. Why? Because it was wildly expensive. And when you pressed people on it, they admitted that they had gotten very few terrorism tips from it. In fact, when a commission that the president put together after the Snowden revelations came back with their report, they could find only one case in which there may have been a terrorist attack prevented because of Section 215 bulk collection, and they even had doubts about that one. And, of course, in return, we were spending huge amounts of money to collect all of this data. So, you know, the NSA had a proposal afoot before Snowden to kill this program. When the president said later on, I really do need something to give up to the critics, the NSA volunteered this one as the sacrificial lamb. And in the other powers that the NSA has for collecting abroad, almost nothing has changed and probably won't change after Congress acts.
David Sanger, national security correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks so much, David.
Thank you, John.
There is one person, former lawmaker, who once thought the Patriot Act was a dubious way of protecting Americans. Republican Dennis Hastert, former Speaker of the House. In fact, the longest-serving Republican Speaker of the House. Here he is speaking back in 2011.
We created the Patriot Act. It was not a popular thing. And I remember the Attorney General calling me up one day and said, I want to move this thing right away. And I said, well, wait a minute. It's got to go through a regular process. Jim Sensenbrenner was the head of the judiciary at that time. And he said, no, I want to go regular process. We're not going to give them carte blanche on this. So, you know, we went through that whole Patriot Act, and which was controversial because it gave the government the same powers against alleged terrorists that we gave them against the mafia. And so you could wiretap and do those types of things.
Well, some of those powers given to the government were apparently the way investigators were tipped off about an alleged Hastert payoff scheme to quietly funnel more than $3 million in smaller chunks to someone in return for not disclosing some bad conduct years ago. The information is contained in an indictment charging that Hastert lied to the FBI and tried to evade currency regulations when he withdrew money from his bank accounts. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, perhaps lawmakers will kill the Patriot Act after what's happened to old, frumpy, squeaky, clean Dennis Hastert, huh?
It was very surprising for a lot of people, and the irony didn't escape a lot of people. The one that you just mentioned, which is that Denny Hastert, a speaker, did help shepherd through the Patriot Act and in a lot of these banking provisions, specifically the ones, John, that prevent you from depositing or withdrawing more than $10,000 without reporting it. You can make those transactions, but you have to report it to the government. The reason that's on the books, apparently, is to prevent terrorists or people who would help them or people laundering money from circulating huge amounts of money that's unreported. Denny Hastert, at first, according to the indictment, after meeting with individual A, who's the person who apparently had bad acts done to them by Denny Hastert, according to the indictment, he had withdrawn $50,000. Then when he got asked questions by the FBI about those withdrawals, lied about it, allegedly said, no, I'm just keeping the cash because I don't trust the banks. And then after that, was withdrawing smaller amounts to get under the reporting requirement. That's illegal, according to the FBI.
Now, I hate to be a beltway dweeb here, but every report on this mentions in about, you know, the 10th paragraph that he, you know, was from Aurora, Illinois, was a teacher and coach in Yorkville, Illinois, before being elected to the Illinois State House of Representatives. Is that some sort of signal that this happened years ago when he was working at a high school?
Here's what the indictment says, John. The indictment says that individual A has been a resident of Yorkville, Illinois, and has known Denny Hastert most of individual A's life. Mm-hmm. It also says that Denny Hastert was a high school teacher in Yorkville before politics from 1965 to 1981, before he was elected to the state house. And then it says that individual A and Denny Hastert met in 2010 to discuss the past bad acts and agreed after those 2010 meetings to the $3.5 million in payments to conceal the bad acts. That's what the indictment says. Now, people, of course, are inferring a lot of things from what is and what isn't in the indictment. I can just tell you what's in there. None of the alleged bad acts, and I know that's a euphemism, they're not outlined in the indictment.
Right.
It doesn't say what they are or who they were against.
But you've helped us to decode things a little bit. I mean, if this individual A is found on a beach somewhere in Aruba, are they liable? I mean, is it illegal for them to accept this money, to make such a deal, Todd?
Well, I'm not really sure the answer to that, because actual blackmail, if that's what you want to call it, isn't alleged in the indictment. What's alleged in here is the non-reporting of the funds and the lying to the FBI. And there has been some criticism, incidentally, in the past of the federal government's use of the statute that lets them go after people for that $10,000 provision unless they can also prove that the thing that they were paying for was also illegal. And that has been controversial in the past. Again, whatever the past bad acts are, they're not alleged in the indictment to be illegal. It just says concealing prior bad acts, the withdrawals without reporting them, apparently illegal, and the lying to the FBI about it.
Well, certainly much of interest there on the Hill regarding Denny Hastert, but he's, you know, a figure of the past. What's the situation on the Patriot Act over the weekend? Do you buy David Sanger's suggestion that when all is said and done, the two provisions will go down?
It's going to be really hard for Congress to get to midnight on Sunday night when these provisions of the Patriot Act expire without them expiring. Here's where we stand. On the Saturday of last week, before the Memorial Day recess, in a late night session, the USA Patriot Act that curbs a lot of this bulk collection and provides narrower restrictions on the government for how they can search the surveillance data, got 57 votes. Mitch McConnell's straight extension of the Patriot Act only got 45. Of course, he needs 60 in either of these cases. McConnell is bringing them back at 4 p.m. on Sunday, and John, nobody around the Senate knows where it goes after that. I've talked to people in the leadership. I've talked to Rand Paul's staff. I've talked to staff of other senators, both for and against the Patriot Act and the NSA provisions. Nobody knows where this goes. Going away entirely? Unlikely. Their Congress is going to preserve the NSA's ability to do this kind of surveillance in certain ways. It's not, the Patriot Act is not going away forever, but it looks pretty likely, unless they come up with a huge Hail Mary pass, John, this thing's going to expire at least for a little while.
And for all of the, you know, sort of double talk of the administration, the White House is staying above the fray here.
Oh, they sure are. They're letting Congress have this fight. The White House has endorsed the USA Patriot Act, which got an overwhelming vote in the House, including support from John Boehner. So they're going to wait and see what Congress can send them. But it's not going to be likely before midnight on Sunday.
And we will wait and see as well. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Have a great weekend.
You too, John.
A struggle with clinical depression involves dealing with constant feelings of uncontrollable guilt, shame, and hopelessness. Treatment generally means daily medication that can be wholly or partially effective. Every person is different. When a woman becomes pregnant, there is concern about any substance taken into the body. Soon-to-be moms swear off drinking and smoking if they can, and closely regard the special side effects of any drug for pregnant women. But pregnancy itself writes new rules for the body and mind, including a powerful form of pregnancy-induced depression, which manifests itself differently because every person is different. An impending birth brings with it fears and anxieties, raises concern for the mentally ill over whether their medications will affect the developing child. Andrew Solomon, author of The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression, has written a piece for the New York Times Sunday Magazine that will be part of the reissue of his book next week. It's all about the complexities and anxieties of women during pregnancy. Andrew, welcome.
What a pleasure to be here.
This is a real puzzle. Describe how concern over medications and drugs and fetus health intertwined with a clinical depression in a particularly tragic story in your piece.
Well, nobody wants to take medication while pregnant, but being depressed while pregnant also carries enormous risks. I've opened the chapter with a story that really compelled me to write more about this, of a woman who had heard that antidepressants were not good for the developing fetus, had a lifetime of dealing with depression, went off her medication thinking she would just white-knuckle it through 9 months, became obsessed with an irrational idea that there was something wrong with her baby, even though every sign was that the fetus was developing just fine, became more and more depressed. Her family kept saying to her, "Don't you think you should go back on medication? You seem not to be in good shape." When she was 6.5 months pregnant, she jumped to her death from the top of the building where her parents lived.
And part of the tragedy here is the family watches this spiral down, and you know, people hold their breath and cross their fingers because there is a sort of indeterminacy about depression, and particularly about depression during pregnancy. You don't really know necessarily where you are.
The risk of medications during pregnancy has been amply documented, and people who search for pregnancy and antidepressants online will frequently find articles which describe the potential downside. And there is a potential downside. I don't want to underplay that. But it's harder to find the information about the dangers of pregnancy itself, depression during pregnancy itself. People who are depressed during pregnancy may have constriction of the uterine artery attached to rising levels of stress hormones that limits the flow of blood to the fetus and to the placenta. They may be more likely to have miscarriages. They may be more likely to have premature births. They may be likely to have all kinds of other problems. The biggest problem, though, is that we've recognized that postpartum depression is very dangerous for a baby, that a mother who's too depressed to take care of her baby ends up with a baby who's traumatized in various ways. And a full half of postpartum depression begins during pregnancy. And so if you don't address it during pregnancy, the long-term negative effects can go well beyond how someone feels during pregnancy and into her ability to take care of her child.
And putting aside the health of the fetus for a moment, I mean, it is the case that depression is hazardous to your health. I mean, the mom needs to be very concerned about these kinds of patterned feelings during a pregnancy.
The mom does. And of course, depression tends to be a recurrent condition. And with each repeated episode, it gets harder to treat. And so someone who is white-knuckling it through pregnancy may develop such an acute depression that she ends up having to deal with it for the rest of her life. And the mother often gets erased in this conversation. What's best for the baby? What's best for the baby? As one remarkable clinician, Betsy Fiddleson, said to me, it's a mistake to treat the baby and the mother at this point as two separate people. Mm. It's a system, and we have to treat the system.
And you know, I said in the introduction that pregnancy itself writes new rules for the body and mind. Is that overstating a situation that we are told is all about shifting hormones and the kinds of things that clinical depression medications attempt to regulate?
Pregnancy, of course, involves enormous hormonal shifts. And there are some women who feel their best during pregnancy, and there are some women who feel their worst during pregnancy. There's now a theory that some women are what's called hormonally sensitive, that they're more likely to develop depression in response to adolescence, in response to their monthly cycle, in response to pregnancy or childbirth or menopause. When you look overall, because some women are very depressed and some women are very exuberant in pregnancy, you get statistics that show that there isn't a big effect on mental health.
You've used the term white knuckle it a couple of times, which really is a sort of reverse depiction of the stigma of mental illness, that somehow a mom is supposed to tough it out in situations that are clearly adverse to her health. And I'm wondering if that comes with this issue of depression. Oh, come on now.
I didn't mean anyone.
No, not that you would say that, but that, right. That's a prevailing notion.
I didn't mean any woman in the course of this research who didn't want to put her baby first, who wasn't trying to do what would be best for the baby. What they didn't recognize was that for them to fall apart was also not good for the baby, and that if they were putting the baby first, in some instances, the best way to do that was by putting themselves first. A mother who's depressed is not helping her child.
But the message mothers typically get is, come on now, you know, hang in there, you know, everyone else does.
The message depressed people get is, come on and pull yourself together. I think we've recognized that there are a lot of brain mechanisms and other mechanisms attached to depression. And the first thing we need to do is not blame women who become depressed during pregnancy. And the second thing we need to do is give them access to whatever treatment there is that will help them. And if they can be helped by talk therapy or if they can be helped by mindfulness training, they should pursue any other option before medication if they can. But if they need the medication, they need to talk to a doctor and weigh up what are the risks of the medication and what are the risks of becoming depressed and try to make a decision that's right for them and for the child.
Andrew Solomon is the author of The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression. The book will be reissued next week with a new chapter on pregnancy and depression. That chapter is excerpted in the Sunday New York Times Magazine. Andrew, thanks so much.
What a pleasure.
Earlier this week, you may have caught our conversation with a former porn actress and the filmmakers behind the documentary Hot Girls Wanted, which explores the reality of young people who answer ads on Craigslist and end up in an abusive dead-end world. On the Takeaway Weekender tomorrow, here are the full conversations with lots of discussion that didn't make it into the program. You get The Weekender when you subscribe to the regular Takeaway podcast, which you can do on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And there's always more on thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like Hungarian, hula hooping, and HTML. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
Well, well, what do you think of this, Wilma? Mighty funny.
Oh, funny how? I mean, funny like I'm a clown. I amuse you.
Oh, my God.
I happen to have Mr. McLuhan right here.
You complete me.
Milk was a bad choice.
We have arrived at Friday when we talk about movies on The Takeaway with our favorites, Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Rafer Guzman, who's a film critic for Newsday as well. How's the podcast?
Doing great.
I never start with the podcast, but what's on the podcast this week?
We're going to be talking about the best fake scientists in the movies with their fake science.
Which leads us directly to the big release, the inescapable big release, which looks a lot like sort of local news footage in L.A., San Andreas. Let's listen to a clip.
Basically, California's entire tectonic plate has shifted. People need to know that the shaking is not over, and it's not aftershocks I'm talking about. San Francisco will get hit again, and it's going to be a bigger monster this time. Our models are predicting a 9.5 or greater. It will be so big that even though it's happening here in California, you will feel it on the East Coast.
California, beware. Another earthquake disaster movie with, you know, what's his real name?
The Rock.
Dwayne Johnson.
Dwayne Johnson, yes. You got to do his real name now.
Exactly.
All right, so what do you think?
Well, there's a lot of spectacle in this, as you might imagine. Lots of skyscrapers crumbling and tsunamis. All that's kind of fun. I think my problem with this film is it has zero sense of humor, absolutely no personality or life. Dwayne Johnson plays an L.A. fire and rescue helicopter pilot. His very first words in the films are, "Just doing my job, ma'am." Delivered completely deadpan, no humor, and I think
hilarious.
That just sets the tone for the entire film.
It's kind of like the O.J. Simpson saving the kitty scene in Towering Inferno.
Exactly. Or Earthquake with Heston in 74. I mean, it's a complete throwback. The special effects are perfectly decent, but the rest of it, the script is just completely scraping the bottom of the barrel.
But still, I mean, you ever lived in California?
I'm from California. I've been waiting for the big one for years.
No twinges here at all.
You get to see the Golden Gate Bridge destroyed. You get to see the Hoover Dam destroyed.
Coit Tower.
My God.
All right. So what do you think, Kristen?
I thought you have to accept us for what this is. This is not going to be intelligent. It's not going to be complex. It's not going to be emotionally rich. It's just going to be a joyride. It's going to be fun. And if you accept it on those terms, you're going to laugh your head off. You're going to cheer. You're going to enjoy the spectacle. That's what I did. I had a great time, Rafer, and I'm so shocked that you couldn't just enjoy what this is. This is a movie starring The Rock. What did you expect?
Now we rebuild.
Is there any neo-feminist deconstruction of this disaster film as we evolve the genre, Kristen? I just thought I'd ask.
Yeah, how's that Carla Gugino character?
It doesn't matter. It's just fun.
Fabulous. Okay, movie number two, Aloha.
I don't even remember why we broke up.
We broke up because you didn't show up on our vacation. You stayed in Guam.
Guam? Really?
Don't pretend like you don't remember.
Hey, you know what? I do remember. You said if you don't show up on this vacation, then that's it.
Because you're a workaholic who creates work to avoid real work.
Yeah, well, I'm still working on that. But to me, you see, a vacation can't be an ultimatum.
All right, this seems like a mega date movie. Beautiful people in a beautiful place. For beautiful couples to come and see. What do you think, Kristen?
It's absolutely horrible. You'll break up if you watch this movie. It's about Cameron Crowe's fantasy world that he creates in every movie about a guy who's kind of a jerk, who somehow has beautiful women who want him, and who tries to redeem himself, but it's so tonally off. You can tell by that clip exactly how much it sounds like the characters aren't even talking to each other, like they recorded their lines in separate rooms. Nobody's motivations make sense. Nobody acts like a real human being in this movie. I cannot say it enough how horrible this movie is.
Ooh, ick.
You know, it's...
Can you top that?
I will say to you, you remember Amy Pascal, the co-chair of Sony, when those emails were leaked, one of them was talking about this film, and she said in a candid email, it never once ever works. And that, I think, is true. This is one of the worst movies. It's got to be the worst movie of the year.
Nothing good
about
this movie.
It's definitely the worst Cameron Crowe movie ever.
They should have put that email on the poster. Rayford Guzman, film critic for Newsday, and Kristen Meinzer, co-host of the Movie Day podcast and producer for The Takeaway. Thanks so much, guys. Have a great weekend.
Thanks,
you too, John.
To see the Golden Gate Bridge destroyed, you get to see the Hoover Dam destroyed. Coit Tower, my God.
In the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the manufacturers controlled the market for apparel. Manufacturers and fashion houses held the power to set prices, and mom-and-pop retailers had to live with it. Today, the situation couldn't be more different. The big retailers like Walmart and Target have the power, and they dictate the price to manufacturers, small shops around the world, making clothing more abundant and affordable than it has ever been. The cost has been borne, though, by people like the victims of the Savar factory collapse in 2013 in Bangladesh.
Well, state media in Bangladesh say an 8-story building has collapsed.
Hundreds are dead. Hundreds more might still be buried alive after officials in Bangladesh say factory owners ignored an order to evacuate.
Garment workers in Bangladesh paying the price for cheap clothing.
The new film, The True Cost, tries to show what the world pays to have cheap clothing. The actual cost can be seen in factories, across landfills, and in the lives of the people who live and die making affordable fashions and all of our smart shopper deals. The film is in theaters and available on demand starting today. The director of the film, Andrew Morgan, says in our fashion world today, the runways are for jumbo jets carrying boxes of clothes from Asia, and there are more seasons than four.
You know, what's distinct about the fast fashion model is it's basically replenishing the design and the product that you see in the store every single day. 2 seasons a year became 4 seasons a year, became 16 seasons a year, and we now consume 400% more clothing than we did just 2 decades ago. We now consume about 80 billion pieces of new clothing. And that form of production is kind of increasing the problems in the model that have always been there, where you're seeing thousands and thousands of factories in a single supply chain, very disconnected from the point of purchase or the company that's marketing the clothes, and just a huge, huge breakdown in some of the responsibility that's leading to some continued really problematic things.
And there's a countercyclical phenomenon between the lowering of the price for consumers and the increase of costs for the actual manufacturers. They're not having any fun here, and you discovered that in China.
That's exactly right, and it is interesting to look at. Clothing has been a deflationary product, and that's a rarity in our world. So you're seeing the price, as you say, go down and down and down, while raw materials are not going down, transportation is not going down, which brings us to possibly the most dangerous point in the supply chain, and that's human labor. That's the one point in the supply chain consistently where the margins are squeezed, and with limited responsibility, with lack of good oversight, with lack of strong rules or outside regulation, that has been what has led this industry to see the continuing, just harrowing effects of this kind of manufacturing.
Tell me about this character in Dongguan, China, who's running a company, I mean, presumably at the top of his field, but not having a lot of success looking forward.
Yeah, well, he's concerned about what he sees. You know, he actually was a very responsible manager, businessman. I think he cares deeply about the people that work for him. And that was one of the things that was eye-opening, I have to say. You know, you go in to a story like this, and I think I was concerned primarily at the beginning with the injustice at the labor level, at the garment factory worker. And then to get to know a lot of these factory owners, and to your point, they're not having a lot of fun. They're being incredibly squeezed.
If you actually go to a store and you benchmark the price of a garment over the last 20 years, you will find that it's actually a deflationary product, i.e. the price has gone down over time. Now, has our cost gone down? Absolutely not. Okay, our cost has gone up.
And he doesn't have anywhere else to squeeze that margin, so he is in a... you know, like a lot of people in his position, a really moral quandary to say, how do I continue to make my business work? At some level, human labor is not a commodity. It's actually lives. And my experience with him was that he felt that very, very deeply. I spent time with another factory owner in Dhaka, Bangladesh, who actually closed his factory, just said, enough is enough. Like, I can't in good conscience, while it's important to employ these people, I cannot squeeze any more what they're being paid, because he's looking at workers who can't afford to live in the city's worst slums.
When the stores are coming to us for an order and negotiating, they're telling, look, that particular store is selling this shirt with like $5, so I needed to sell it in the $4. So you better squeeze your price. So we are squeezing. Then other store is coming and selling, hey, they're selling it the $4, so the target price is $3. If you can meet the $3, you are getting business, otherwise you are not getting. In the West, they're using everyday low price. So every day they're hampering me and I'm hampering my workers. This is how it is.
So take us someplace that is particularly memorable. I mean, I think of Bangladesh because I cannot get those images out of my mind of that factory collapse. But where would you take me?
Well, beyond just Bangladesh, there's certainly a powerful story continuing to unfold there. But I think one of the other things that we don't talk about quite as much is beyond the human labor sides that we can, I'm sure, discuss more. You know, when you hear a number like 400% more clothes in two decades, that is coming at an incredible price to the natural world. The amount of resources that go into these clothes is absolutely staggering. So when you begin to market and treat clothing as a disposable good, that's a really distinct change in the historical way we've treated clothing. And on the natural resources level, that's alarming. And on the waste level, that's really alarming. That was something I had no idea of going in.
Does brand shaming work to change conditions in the field, in your experience in this film?
You know, I think at times it has played a role. We saw coming out of the factory collapse at Rana Plaza, the most memorable recent disaster in Bangladesh, we saw some failure for brands that were manufacturing there to pay into a compensation fund. And there was some activism work to really protest and say, like, you know, you have to pay up to compensate these workers. But for brands, I think there's got to be a huge, huge wake-up call to a rediscovery of responsibility. And same thing for government. I think there has to be an actual impetus to lead. So I think we could short sight and create a really shallow solution if we went too narrow in our attack. And that's why in the film we tried to not make it a story about one company, but really say, this is a mess. This is a mess we've allowed ourselves to create, and something that we have to see be done much better moving forward.
Does the Pacific Trade Agreement that's in Congress address those gaps, or does it enshrine those gaps?
In my opinion, it goes further to enshrine those gaps. I think trade agreements are a profound tool that we could use to start to protect the environment, natural resources, as well as human labor. The market, business, trade, globalization, these things are a force. And they can be a real force for good, and they have done real good. But it's just like if we were playing soccer, there have to be some basic rules. And those rules don't have to kill competition. They don't have to end the game. But what we've seen up until now, and what the trade agreement you're mentioning further enshrines, is that the rules are getting written by the people that are on the field. And I think that's what we're saying is really profoundly problematic.
Andrew Morgan is the director of the film The True Cost, in theaters and on demand starting today. And here's something to take with you today. A paper from the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences indicates that groups do better than individuals at detecting lies for three reasons. Each individual's judgment may improve the odds of success. Individuals are prone to believing others. The phenomenon is called truth bias. But in groups, they all become better skeptics. And third, group discussion can help tease out information that each individual on his or her own may have missed. Perhaps the National Academy may have heard of juries? That's all for today. Hope you don't meet 12 disagreeing, angry men or women on your weekend. Take the takeaway with you, though. Subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes and take us with you on your commute home from work. It's a great way to stay up on the news. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, providing users with tools to create websites for small business or their own personal brand. More information at squarespace.com/takeaway. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.